Have you ever wondered what it's like to witness a murder?
Forrest grabbed the knife and then just stabbed Johnny in one motion.
Or how it feels to be shot?
I was immediately hit by a barrage of bullets.
Or how you would react if your spouse hired someone to kill you?
And he was to put me in a grave with a bullet wound on my head.
These are the stories you'll hear on the podcast called What Was That Like? True stories told by the actual person who went through it. You'll hear from a stalking victim.
Came back upstairs, and when I came back and turned the corner into my room, I saw him standing there.
You'll hear from a man who was kidnapped and tortured.
I would do anything, say anything, to simply get away.
And you'll hear actual 911 calls.
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Real people in unreal situations. Search for What Was That Like on any podcast app, or at whatwasthatlike.com.
This podcast contains adult themes and language, and some of the things that we discuss may be disturbing to some listeners. In this podcast, we discuss sexual assault, torture, race, and murder. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to Fruit Loops episode 179. We TP Nafi, bienvenidos bitches. Thank you so much for listening.
Yeah.
Now, listen up. Fruit Loops is a podcast about true crimes committed by people of color and the victims that we don't hear or know much about. Contrary to popular belief, not all serial killers are straight, cisgender white dudes. And cisgender is not an insult. It's just the way it is. Now, anyway, there are many well-documented cases of serial killers of color, and Fruit Loops is a podcast all about them. We will take deep dives into the fascinating lives and crimes of serial killers and true crimes committed by people of color and the victims that the media and entertainment commonly leave out, because listen up, the news is racist, allegedly.
And we are Wendy and Beth. She's Wendy, a Black Latinx woman, and I'm Beth, and I just happen to be white.
That's right. And it is not her fault, and we love her anyway.
We're not journalists, investigators, or psychologists. Just a couple of gals interested in true crime. Also, the opinions expressed in this podcast are just that, our opinions. Please send any questions or comments to fruitloopspod@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 602-935-6294. And we may feature it on a future episode.
Also, our website is fruitloopspod.com, and we use Fruit Loops Pod for all our social media. The footnotes for each episode can be found on our website. Plus, check it out for the different ways that you can support the show and become a Fruit Loops Patreon. Oh me, oh my. You can also support us by supporting our sponsors.
Yes.
Now, who are we talking about today, Beth?
Today we're talking about Kenyell William Brown, who was charged with a series of murders which occurred in three cities in Wayne County, Michigan between December 2019 and February 2020. And this episode was researched and written by Minnie.
Oh yes, now he traveled far and fast.
Yeah.
But before we get into it, how you doing?
I'm all right. I had to go to urgent care this morning. Not a big deal, but
friend.
My eyelid was infected. I had a sty last week, and then it went away, and then my upper eyelid was starting to get all puffy, and I wasn't worried about it. I figured it would go away, but then it like spread, and like my whole, all around my eye was all puffy. I was like, oh my God. I was just worried that like it would like infect my whole head or something.
Oh my God. Infect your whole head. Infections are weird like that. So I'm glad you took the necessary precautions and took care of yourself. Did you get to, you didn't have to go back to work, did you?
Oh, I did go to work. Yeah, I feel fine.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, I went to work.
girl.
First thing in the morning, I went to urgent care and then I went to work. Yeah.
Everybody knows the best part about work is the sick time.
Yeah.
And you didn't take it. Wow. Well, see, that's my white friend.
I can't. There's nobody at work.
Our
staff is like a skeleton.
It's bare bones. Yeah.
Yeah.
So. I know. Yeah. But you care too much.
Had to get done.
Work will never give you a hug back, Beth.
That's
never.
True. That's true. Never. But it does give me money.
Yeah, that's a good point. That is a very good point. Now, I was told when I was a child by the black and brown women in my life that you get a sty on your eye from watching a dog poop.
Oh, geez. I guess I shouldn't have been doing that.
I've never had one because every time I see a dog poop,
I close your eyes.
I turn my head real fast or close my eyes. So I'm just putting it out there. I mean, there's got to be something.
Okay,
to
well,
those
I'll stop. I'll stop.
Central American black and brown women are telling me. all right. Well, I'm glad you're doing okay. I cannot believe you went to work. I would never. I have a hangnail. I can't come in today. But let's get into these listener letters, shall we?
Yeah, let's do it. Hello, angels. Thank you.
You went to work after going to urgent care. This girl, I can't believe it. Woo! Okay, everybody. What's in that bag, Beth? Wow.
Well, we got a letter from someone in Ireland.
Oh, yes.
She wanted us to try and pronounce her name, and it's spelled, let me tell you the spelling.
Okay.
It's A-O-I-F-E.
Yes.
And she gave us the pronunciation, but I'm going to read it how how I thought maybe it was pronounced.
Okay, go.
Ayoifi.
Me too. That's what I thought too.
Ayoifi. Yeah.
And you know what it reminds me of is the name, and another Irish name, I think, is Siobhan.
Yeah. And it's spelled like
Sioban. Sioban. Yes. And yeah. I've done a shout out to a Siobhan and called her Sioban. And I believe she is still a supporter of the show. And I'm so sorry, Siobhan. But I also want to say thank you, Aoife.
Yeah, it's pronounced Aoife.
Aoife. For setting us straight.
Yeah.
We do our best to pronounce things correctly. We fail most of the time, but this is very, very helpful.
Yeah.
So Hip Hop Air Horns 2 are our new, she's actually a new Patreon.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So guess what? You get a tune and you get a tune and you get a tune. So here goes. Oh no, they're dead. They are dead. Aoife, 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 ha, ha, hey, ho, 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 Aoife. Okay, I hope you like that. Sorry. Okay, so we're going to take a quick break. I'm going to gather myself together and then get back into the story when we come back.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.
All right, so let's talk about batteries, specifically social batteries.
Okay.
Now, during the winter, you know, like my battery was like really drained and I really just couldn't wait for it to be over. And now that winter is gone, I am feeling more energized socially. So
nice.
I can manage having friends over at my house and going out to do things. But I have to do a lot of mental preparing.
Yeah.
And then I also have to have time to recover from the people and the things.
Oh, yeah. I get that. And I know there are people out there who are energized and even thrive on being around people.
Yeah.
But I am definitely not one of those people.
No, ma'am. the thing is, you know, sometimes our batteries can get drained when we say yes to all the things and to all the people. And we forget to, you know, set boundaries and set aside time and space for ourselves.
Everyone's different.
Right.
And the good news is that therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery.
Well, that sounds great.
Yeah.
I definitely had many sessions with my therapist about boundaries and positive coping skills. And therapy is, dare I say, empowering.
Yeah.
And it can help you become the bestest version of yourself and can help you determine when your battery is beyond depleted or needs a refresher.
Yeah. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule.
Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge.
Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/fruit today to get 10% off your first month.
That's BetterHelp.com/fruit.
True terrors of horror, bizarre happenings, unexplainable events. On our podcast, Disturbed, terror takes center stage. Each episode is a journey into the darkest corners of human existence, delving into bone-chilling tales of kidnappings, serial killers, maniacs, and the very essence of your worst nightmares coming to life on this weekly true horror show. Disturbed is not for the faint of heart. It's an exploration of real, unadulterated horror sourced from everyday people. Each episode is a descent into the macabre, where we narrate stories that will leave you on the edge of your seat and crawling in your skin. We navigate the disturbing narratives that lurk in the shadows, offering a raw and unfiltered listen into the most terrifying aspects of the human experience. Enter at your own risk and let the unsettling tales unfold in the haunting realm of Disturbed. And remember, listeners, stay safe out there.
Okay, we are back. Remind us, Beth, who is our subject today?
Our subject today is Kenyell William Brown, who was the prime suspect in a series of murders that occurred in Wayne County, Michigan.
Okay, so we are going to get into some estayayayats. Now, Mr. Brown was the person who committed 6 murders and 2 carjackings. All of the victims in this case were Black. And so we want to say rest in power to the victims and thoughts and prayers to the loved ones and the community left in the wake of these terrible crimes. So rest in power, kings and queens. Their names are 31-year-old Lauren Haddington, 48-year-old Dorian Patterson, 52-year-old Kimberly Green, 49-year-old Garcius Woodyard, 41-year-old Amir Thaxton, 36-year-old Eugene Jennings, and another victim, 44-year-old Clifton Smith, was shot but non-lethally wounded. So now it's time for the setting. Take us there, Beth.
Well, these crimes took place in Wayne County, Michigan, where Detroit is the county seat. We've talked in depth about Detroit before, but as usual, we do want to mention that the land where Michigan sits was originally inhabited by non-Europeans. When the first European explorers invaded, the most populous tribes were Algonquin peoples, who included the Anishinaabe groups of Ojibwe, Ottawa, and Potawatomi.
Oh, and I'll get into it in our shout-outs, but I wanted to say I listened to a really great podcast this week about the trauma that comes with Indigenous Peoples Day. We're recording this the week of Thanksgiving.
Right.
And they talk about specifically the Indigenous peoples like east of the Mississippi.
Uh-huh.
Who were there before the colonizers came. And I will be sure to shout that out.
All right.
So the three nations coexisted peacefully as part of a loose confederation called the Council of Three Fires. Ojibwe, also known as Chippewa in the United States, whose numbers are estimated to have been between 25,000 and 35,000, were the largest.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
The Ojibwe also inhabited parts of Ontario and Manitoba, Canada, and parts of present-day Wisconsin and Minnesota. The Ottawa people lived primarily south of the Straits of Mackinac in Michigan, but also in southern Ontario, northern Ohio, and eastern Wisconsin. The Potawatomi people were in southern and western Michigan, in addition to northern and central Indiana, northern Illinois, southern Wisconsin, and southern Ontario. So they were all over the land there.
Yeah, which makes sense because they were there first for millennia.
It was their land. Yeah.
Wow. So other Algonquin tribes in Michigan in the south and east were the Maskoutin, the Menominee, the Miami, the Sac or Sauk, and the Meskwaki or Fox. The Wyandot were an Iroquoian people in this area, historically known as the Huron by the French.
Wayne County was the sixth county in the Northwest Territory, formed on August 15th, 1796. It was named for the U.S. General Anthony Wayne, a.k.a. Mad Anthony.
Oh boy, this sounds like a white guy who didn't do good things.
Yeah.
Okay.
Allegedly, it was due to his aggressive leadership in combat and fiery personality.
Okay, so on November 1st, 1798, Wayne County was divided into four townships of Detroit, Hamtramck, Mackinac, and Sargent. At that time, Wayne County included all the present state of Michigan, plus parts of Indiana, Ohio, and Wisconsin. The historic Guardian Building in Detroit is the Wayne County headquarters.
Wayne County is the most populous county in Michigan. In 2020, the population was approximately 1,750,000. The largest ethnic groups in Wayne County, Michigan are white at 49%, black at 38%, Asian at 3%, and Latinx at 3%.
What's interesting about those stats, I'm so glad you read them, is that it was 100% indigenous.
Yeah.
And now look at those numbers. So
yeah.
River Rouge, where Kenyell Brown grew up, is named after, well, the River Rouge, which is French for Red River. And it flows along the city's northern border and into the Detroit River. It is a suburb of Detroit in Wayne County.
Detroit and River Rouge were situated between the iron ore of the Upper Peninsula and the coal mines in the eastern American states. And the industry that drove much of Detroit's growth in the 19th and early 20th centuries relied on the city's waterways for transportation of ore and other goods.
And I know that the waterways were important in an American context, but I believe, and I don't know this, don't fact check me, but I'm sure the indigenous people were also doing the same
absolutely.
Before that.
Yeah, they used it for traveling and stuff.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. It became an intersection of immigration and trade. Detroit's population grew in the 1800s before exploding in the 1900s, an era characterized by immigration, industrialization, and rapid growth.
In 1917, Henry Ford began construction on his Ford River Rouge complex. It measured 1.5 miles wide and 1 mile long.
Mm, wow.
Yeah, it's big. Mm-hmm. To support such a massive effort, Ford dredged and channeled the Rouge River to the Ford plant, fundamentally altering the landscape and creating Fordson Island in the process.
Wow. Created a whole island in the name of capitalism.
Yep.
My son was doing a project on Henry Ford, Babe Ruth, and Lucky Lindy. And I was like, oh, Henry Ford. My son was like, he was doing a presentation. He revolutionized the assembly line and the quick construction of things. And I was like, is wild racist anywhere in your text that you are reading? Wild anti-Semite. Is that in there? Okay. Well, then this book is wrong. Anyway, when the River Rouge complex was completed in 1928, it was the largest integrated plant in the world. Mass production on this scale had never been seen before. During the Depression, it employed 100,000 workers, and during World War II, it helped with the war effort by building bombers and tanks.
More factories were built and blanketed the banks of the River Rouge. But with all this industrial growth came pollution, placing a lot of stress on the river. Due to a lack of environmental regulation, the factories along the River Rouge polluted the river seemingly without restraint.
Mm.
In 1965, the Dearborn Guide called the waterway the state's most polluted river.
I 1965, we knew.
Yeah.
We knew.
We knew.
this was not bad. Good. Yeah. Anyway, so in 1969, a construction worker accidentally dropped a torch on the river. About 3,000 gallons of oil had accidentally spilled from the Shell Oil Company refinery. Oopsies, didn't know we couldn't do that. And the torch ignited the oil. The flames rose 50 feet in the air.
Wow.
That is so terrible.
Nuts.
No big deal, though. No big deal. Before the Clean Water Act in 1972, rivers catching fire were quite common and nobody seemed alarmed.
Oh, the river's on fire. No big deal.
Is anybody else paying attention? What the fuck? Oh my God. Wow. Yeah. I'm so ashamed of us.
I know. Before 1985, little action was taken by the government or industry to clean up the river. Dissolved oxygen in the river declined, and wildlife biodiversity lessened. Migratory patterns of birds were disrupted as fish species died out.
Another problem. People should have been alarmed.
They should have known
and
better.
And I'm certain if they had listened to and respected the indigenous people who had been there before, they would have told you all this was coming. You know, this should not be a surprise. But however, things changed after a man fell into the Rouge River, contracted rat fever. That doesn't sound good.
No.
An infectious disease caused by bacteria, and he died. The health department then warned the public to avoid the river. The Department of Natural Resources and the Michigan Water Resources Commission began pushing for strategies to clean up the river.
By the 1990s, the price tag for cleaning up the river had come to $2 billion.
In the 90s. Wow.
$1 billion. Yeah. For cleaning up the river, when had they been not polluting the river in the first place?
Mm-hmm. Right. You know? Yeah.
And that's our tax dollars.
Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think people, you know, industry is like, we got to make all this money and keep producing all this stuff and all these factories. But you can also create jobs and environmentally sound jobs that employ people to fix this stuff or make this stuff better and safer for the environment and for the human beings who inhabit this earth. But
we don't have to pollute.
Billionaires are really, I just am so disgusted from with them after, especially Behind the Bastards. And they're just awful.
Awful.
And this is evidence of their work.
Yes. But in 2013, the beaver, which once populated the area in the millions, but had been declared extinct from it more than 100 years prior, had returned.
Wow. Look at that. Okay, so that's some progress.
That's good.
That doesn't happen without people working together and working hard.
Yeah.
So in 1986, only 6 kinds of fish were found and more than half were sick. In 2015, they found 13 species and 353 individual fish. What? Just 353?
I know.
That is abysmal. However,
I know, but it's better than 6.
You know what? You're right. It is. She's right. Absolutely. She's up. You know what? Round of applause for Beth, because she is absolutely right. It is 353 is way better than 6. However, health officials say the water is still contaminated and could be dangerous for anyone to go in it.
The city had its peak of population in 1950, when industry was still the mainstay of the local economy. But restructuring of heavy industry and movement of jobs offshore have resulted in large population loss.
Yeah. Too big to fail, right?
Yeah.
So in 2015, the population was less than half of what it was in 1950. Many workers who had the flexibility to seek jobs elsewhere moved away, which resulted in a shift in the racial demographics of the city as it became less white and more black.
And if you take a Google street walk in River Rouge, you'll see it looks similar to other places in Detroit where lived-in houses sit next to boarded-up houses or empty lots where fires may have burned out previously inhabited homes. It looks like the Detroit fires, which we talked about in episode 171 about James C. Brown, were raging in this area as well.
Yes. I just watched a movie that took place in Detroit called Don't Breathe. Have you seen that one? A horror movie?
No.
It takes place in Detroit.
I don't really watch horror.
Oh, what? Yeah. But you love true crime. I'm confused. Anyway.
I think because it gives me too much anxiety. I don't know.
Oh, interesting.
Like just while I'm watching it.
Yes.
And true crime doesn't, for whatever reason.
Wow. This is my weird friend, everyone.
I know. She goes to
work after going to urgent care.
And she can't watch horror.
She can't
but she
watch
loves
horror.
True crime.
Yeah. And she has Preet Bharara's name tattooed on her belly and cuddles with a John Douglas pillow every night. This is our OG. Yes, this is our OG of true crime. So now we're
going
to get into the early life of Kenyell William Brown. So Kenyell Brown was a black man and he was born on July 3rd, 1979. So he grew up and went to school in River Rouge, and we didn't find much specific detail about Kenyell's childhood home life, but a childhood friend who grew up with him remembers him as a gifted athlete with a serious drug habit.
Doing drugs. Quote, he was a star basketball player on the street and at the Beachwood Center in River Rouge. He was the best, but he had a bad cocaine problem. He went to prison and we never saw him even after he was paroled, unquote.
By the time the murders in the episode occurred, Brown had grown to stand 5'8" tall and he weighed about 170 to 180 pounds. So now it's time to dive into the timeline. Splish, splash, take us there, Beth.
In 1997, at the age of 18, Brown was convicted of carrying a concealed weapon and felony assault with a dangerous weapon. In 1999, the now 20-year-old Brown was convicted of fleeing a police officer and on a separate occasion of attempting to illegally use a taser. So he's running wild in the streets out there.
He's what we say wilding.
Yes, he's wilding.
Yes. It was the 90s. From 1997 to 2000, Wayne County court records show that Brown entered plea deals in 6 cases. In 2000, Brown, now 21, was convicted of fleeing a police officer. That same year, Brown was charged with second-degree murder.
Oh my god.
You see this guy? You know what reminds me of? Remember the bagel boss guy? You're not my boss. You're not my god. You're not my father. You're not my mother. So with a second degree murder and 4 vehicle related felonies in a River Rouge homicide.
In a plea deal, he got the second degree murder charges dismissed by pleading guilty in January 2001 to felony charges of fleeing and eluding a police officer.
Do you see that? The career, an existence of a police officer is more valuable than the murder that occurred.
Yeah.
Just let that sink in. It's pretty disgusting, if you ask me.
Yeah, it really is. He was sentenced to prison as a habitual 4th offender. According to the Michigan Department of Corrections, he was paroled in 2010 and discharged from parole the next year.
According to federal court records, Brown was charged in 2015 with being a felon in possession of a gun after being caught with a loaded pistol. It was his 3rd gun offense. He faced a minimum of 15 years in prison under a then federal law that was designed to punish repeat violent offenders. But no law to fix the problems that lead people to crimes, huh?
Okay. Yeah, no, none of that. No, throw them in jail. And everything will be fine.
Okay.
Sweep it under the rug.
Yep, all right.
But in 2015, the U.S. Supreme Court declared part of the law unconstitutional, a ruling that cut Brown's guidelines to 15 to 21 months. That same year, Brown cut another deal, pleading guilty to felon in possession. Brown was sentenced to 21 months in prison, followed by 2 years of supervised release.
And I don't know, a little spoiler alert, I don't think his time in prison helped him rehabilitate.
No, I don't think so.
Nope. So after Brown was released, he failed drug tests and removed his tether during supervised release. His supervised release was revoked and he was placed back in prison. But in July 2017, he was out again and the violations continued. And the parole violations are actually easier to make than you think.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't drink. You can't associate with people who commit crimes. You can't do this. You can't do that. You can't stay out past a certain time. You have to have a job, which is hard to do because of the convicted felony box that they make you check on job applications. It's easier than you think. Brown was a piece of shit. I'm just saying that.
Easier to violate than you think.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you. So Brown tested positive for cocaine and marijuana, and he missed his drug treatment meetings. Oops. All of this should have landed him back in prison.
However, on October 29th, 2019, U.S. District Judge Bernard Friedman held what was supposed to be a sentencing hearing for Brown, who had failed drug tests, got arrested for drunken driving, and missed mandatory meetings, among other things, all while on supervised release for felony convictions.
But instead, Friedman released him at the request of a federal law enforcement agency that, for reasons not disclosed, wanted Brown freed. Now, Friedman never mentioned that request in court, though he did tell the defendant that while he was aware that he, quote, had a hard time following the law, unquote, he was going to give him a break. There were no objections from the prosecution.
Friedman told Brown, quote, stay out of trouble. I don't want to see you again, okay? Unquote. That should do it, you know?
Okay. The judge
yeah,
said.
All right.
Yep.
Brown thanked the judge. That same day, the Detroit police signed Brown on as an informant, working for a Detroit DEA task force.
"3 AM, the comedy horror podcast that holds weekly gatherings around the campfire. Let me tell you what you're going to get. You're going to hear stories about demonic possessions, prison stabbings, skinwalkers, glitches in the Matrix, cult leaders, missing 411, night marchers, Operation Paperclip, Mesopotamian devil worship, and so many monsters it'll give Kanye West a runaway for his money. Pop and meme culture also aren't off topic. A camp where laughs and scares are constantly competing for first place. We're just a group of friends, trying to bust each other's balls, find the best stories, and expand the circle in the process. 3 AM, the comedy horror podcast, not for the faint or fragile of heart. Let's go.
I want to take a moment to tell you about my podcast, Carol Costello Presents Blind Rage. In 1984, a woman named Phyllis Cottle was abducted in broad daylight, tortured, and left to die in a burning car in Akron, Ohio. At the time, I was a rookie reporter covering this horrific story. Since then, I've reported every kind of crime imaginable. I've been able to leave most of them at work, but not this one, the one that buried itself under my skin and stayed put. Phyllis Cottle was a badass woman, and I want to tell you her story. A production of Evergreen Podcasts and signature title of the Killer Podcast Network, you can find Carol Costello Presents Blind Rage wherever you get your podcasts. Discover more great true crime and paranormal programming at killerpodcast.com.
Now, the informant thing is interesting, and I'll get into it more in my takeaways, but I didn't know much about informants, or I hadn't thought about it much until we did this case.
Right.
Because they're paid for by taxpayers. Right. So anyway, less than 2 months later, on December 7th, 2019, Lauren Harrington, age 31, and the proud father of 8 children, was shot multiple times at his home on the 500 block of Beechwood in River Rouge. Lauren died from his wounds.
On January 8th, 2020, Brown was identified as the man who had shot and killed Lauren. Knowing the police were now after him for the murder, he began moving around, crashing at various acquaintances' homes, not staying in one place for very long.
On January 30th, 2020, Brown came over to Gerald Patterson's apartment where Gerald lived with his brother Dorian. Gerald later said that he hadn't seen Brown for years. They had been childhood friends, though. But, quote, a few months ago, he popped up out of nowhere and started hanging around my house. He and my brother would sit in the living room drinking beer. There didn't seem to be any problems, unquote.
Except for the hanging around drinking beer all the time.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it was summer. Every day in his mind.
Oh, it was January. Oh, in his mind.
Okay.
I was going to say, January. Yeah. Well, maybe they were just trying to keep warm in January.
Maybe. Rosé all day, except with beer.
that afternoon when Gerald left for work, his brother Dorian was in the living room with friends Kimberly Green and Clifton Beau Smith, as well as Brown. Gerald later said that they were just partying and it was nothing unusual.
Then, quote, later on, when I was at work, I called my sister who told me, a whole lot of police are at your house. I called Dorian and he didn't answer. It's not like him to not answer the phone, so I started to get worried.
When I got off work, I tried to get into my house and the police stopped me and told me I couldn't go inside because they told me this is a crime scene. The police asked me who I knew who was wearing an army fatigue jacket. And I knew they were talking about Brown, unquote.
Ooh, so Dorian Patterson, 48, and Kimberly Green, 52, both died of multiple gunshot wounds after being shot in Dorian's apartment. 44-year-old Clifton Beau Smith was also shot in the same incident, but he had been able to get away, flag down a passing River Rouge police cruiser, and direct an officer to the apartment. He identified the shooter as Brown, who had fled the scene. Beau spent some time in critical condition in the hospital, but he survived.
Dorian's fiance, Precious Moore, struggled to understand and cope with the loss of Dorian. She later said, quote, he was a kind-hearted man. He should still be alive, unquote.
Kimberly Green worked as a healthcare service provider in Ann Arbor and was devoted to helping other people. She was described as a phenomenal, beautiful woman with a huge heart. Her daughter Brianna later said that her mother was in the wrong place at the wrong time. Quote, she just happened to be visiting with friends. She's not connected to Brown in any way, unquote.
The family held a vigil for her during which they lit candles and released balloons to honor her. A cousin, Royce Jackson, who thought of Kimberly as a sister, said, quote, she was an angel. We lost a beautiful soul unnecessarily, untimely, for no reason. Our family is devastated. We want justice, unquote.
Yeah, I think what is the word she used? This unnecessarily is
and untimely,
untimely, senseless. All those things came to mind when looking into this case.
Yeah.
So on February 3rd, 2020, Detroit police removed Brown as an informant after learning that he was a person of interest in the double homicide and the attempted homicide of Beau Smith. On February 4th, Brown was charged with two counts of first degree murder as well as an assault with intent to murder in connection with the incident. Police intensified their search for him, placing him on Detroit's most wanted list and distributing his information and image through news media.
On February 18th, 2020, a woman noticed a white pickup truck running on Church Street when she left her home at about 6 a.m. When she returned home in the evening, she saw the truck was still running. Yikes.
Whoa.
Yeah. So she looked in the window and saw a man slumped over in the passenger's seat.
She called police, who came to investigate and discovered that the man was Garcius Woodyard and that he had apparently been beaten to death and left in the running truck.
Oh, my God.
Some accounts of the incident say that he was shot in the head, so he may have been both beaten and shot. Police believe that while in Highland Park, Brown had killed 49-year-old Garcius. Garcius was from Ypsilanti, a city west of Detroit.
2 days later, on February 20th, 2020, 41-year-old Amir Thaxton was working late at the Next Level Custom Tees shop on the 16,000 block of East 8 Mile on Detroit's east side. Amir was a graphic artist at Next Level Custom Apparel and was the man behind the brands Gorilla Hustle and Beautiful Hustle. It wasn't unusual for him to work late because he was known for working hard to provide for his three children.
This feels like a moment for Culture Corner. So t-shirt making is, I want to say, a staple in Black culture for business reasons. Whenever there's a funeral or somebody is shot or killed early, their name always goes on a t-shirt. There's always a t-shirt with the pictures of them in heaven.
I've seen those.
Yeah. And I think it's an easy business to relatively, as far as Black people are concerned, because, you know, we can't get loans and stuff like that, but low startup costs and easy to produce product and sell. So anyway, I just wanted to mention that. It sounds like Amir was doing good things in his community. Amir was shot inside the store and left to die. Amir's body was found at about 11 p.m. that night. Police later said Amir and Brown were acquaintances and the motive behind the murder was likely robbery. To add insult to injury, Brown allegedly stole Amir's car after robbing and murdering
him. Oh my God.
What a dick.
Wow. Yeah. Amir was described by his family as a loving father. His family was in shock and struggling to accept the loss. News media interviewed his cousin, Angie Brand, who said that all she has left of him now is a shirt he made for her business.
Mm. Yeah, I feel that. That's what I have a lot. I have so many shirts with relatives' faces on them.
Wow.
I get that. So by this time, Brown was connected to the other murders as well, with wanted info being circulated via news media for his capture. Angie had this to say to him at that time. Quote, "These are people who have families, a parent, a father, a grandfather, brothers, nephews. You are taking people's family members. How dare you?" Unquote. And you tell him, Angie. I mean, we see you, and I am glad that you said that, because the news media, this is also another thing that happens when BIPOC people are killed in a violent way. The media will paint them as bad people. And yeah. So I'm glad
somehow it was their fault.
Exactly. And so I'm really glad that she humanized them in that moment and was brave enough to do so. So hip hop air horns to Angie.
After Amir's murder, police circulated additional information through news media, stating that they had information that Kenyell Brown likes to shoot when he's high or gets angry. So he just likes to shoot people, I guess.
Okay.
U.S. Marshals also began offering a $10,000 reward for information that would lead to Brown's arrest.
On February 21st, 2020, you know what else is striking about this is how close this is to that week we all shut down. You know, this
spree. Oh, yeah, 2020. Right. Yeah.
So on February 21st, 2020, Brown allegedly carjacked a vehicle at 5 p.m. on Berg Road in Detroit. About 20 minutes later, he allegedly carjacked another vehicle on the block of Braille Street, also in Detroit. Born and raised in South Detroit, which isn't a real region because South Detroit is Canada. Next, sorry.
On February 22nd, 2020, at about 1:45 p.m., the body of 36-year-old Eugene Jennings was found in a vacant building on the 20 block of Minnesota in Detroit. He was also believed to have been murdered by Brown, this time over a drug dispute. Eugene was the father of five children, ages 2 to 14, and was described by loved ones as a selfless man who held his family together.
Friends and family held a vigil for him with about 100 attendees at the vacant house where he had been found. They lit candles and released balloons in his honor. Is that the one with the red and black balloons? I don't know if you watched the video. I think I saw the video on the news. Anyway, so Eugene's aunt, Cheryl Johnson, said during the vigil, quote, "Absolutely senseless. I don't understand it myself, but with the strength of God, we will get through it," unquote. So now it's time to get into the investigation and the arrest. Hit it, Beth.
On February 23rd, 2020, in their search for Brown, U.S. Marshals, officers from the Detroit Police Department, Michigan State Police, the FBI, and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives zeroed in. That's a lot. That is a lot.
That is a lot of, wow. Is all that necessary? People, wow.
Probably not, but probably each one of them wanted to get the credit.
Oh my God. Do the perp lock and the press conference.
Yep.
Oh,
yep.
It all makes sense now. Okay.
Yeah. So all of these people zeroed in on a home Sunday in Highland Park. They had received a tip regarding Brown's location, but he was not present at the home. So,
yeah, you're not going to get me today. Oh, well, hang on a second, Mr. Brown, because this story is not over yet. So through news media, Detroit Police Commander Darren Zilagi informed residents that they should consider Brown to be armed and very dangerous. Quote, "This subject is wanted for multiple shootings. He's very, very dangerous. And our law enforcement partners, including Detroit Police Department, really need to get this suspect in custody," unquote.
News stories and information became more widespread as Brown continued to elude capture. Police said he would befriend people and convince them to let him stay at their homes, but that people needed to be wary of him.
And police said, police claimed. The right. police provided a lot of the information, that they were reporting on. And so, you know, I don't know how reliable they are all the time, but okay. So they also began to circulate information that they were going to investigate anybody, any one of you who aided Brown in eluding capture. By then, the information about the $10,000 reward offered by U.S. Marshals for assistance in his capture had been widely circulated as well.
So the net's closing. Yes. It's closing in.
Yes. Yeah. We're almost done.
On February 24th, 2020, Brown decided it was time to make a visit to an adult bookstore in Oak Park, where he'd been kicked out the previous week for doing drugs.
Doing drugs in the sex shop? Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah. So that, all of those things, very solid choices. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I don't know. Have you ever been to one of those
adult bookstores?
Yeah, but with the arcade in it.
No.
Okay, so we used to live down the street from one, and the stench inside.
It smells
like they're trying to cover it up with ammonia, but it doesn't really go away.
That's disgusting.
Yeah, it is really something. Ugh, but, you know, gross. I'm all about, I'll try anything once, and I did, and I don't need to go back.
So anyway, the clerk recognized him from the news and from the previous week when he'd caused trouble in the shop.
The clerk called 911 to report Brown being in the store, but by the time the police arrived, he had fled.
God, this guy is slippery.
Yeah, he is. He is. And he had realized by then that the police were zeroing in on where he was and were after him with multiple squads and canine search dogs. So he began running through the neighborhood, through people's homes, hopping fences, and making his way through their yards trying to hide. This is for many. Do you think they had milkshakes in their yards that brought him to, you know, their yards? My milkshake brings all the boys to the yard, and they're like, it's better than yours. It's like a do charge of milkshake brings all the boys to the yard. So, what do you say, Beth?
So, yeah, pretty sure there's no milkshakes in this situation.
Damn it to hell.
So police closed in on him in the backyard on the 20,000 block of Ridgedale in Oak Park, while the owner, a senior citizen and Vietnam vet, watched, stunned, quote, "It just sounded like pop, pop, pop along the inside of my fence in the backyard. I saw about 10 police officers. The police just kept coming and coming and coming," unquote. Wow.
Yeah. So it turns out that the popping sounds were fence planks being kicked in by police.
Whoa.
So they could get into the yard. And I was looking at his yard at the news report, because it was still broken when the news was there. And I was like, I hope that the police department pays for that. Yeah.
Shit.
Jeez Louise. The owner of the house, who wanted to remain anonymous, wasn't aware that Brown was in his yard hiding under his grandchildren's swing set. Under the swing set. This guy and his choices. Wow.
How are you going to hide under a swing set? Just like lay there and pretend that you're grass?
I don't know. Because I don't know if you've seen a swing set recently, but they're not great places.
No,
nobody's like, I call the swing set on hide and seek, because you would lose. You would lose the game if you did that. So
and he lost.
He did.
He lost.
Big time. Big time. And deservedly so, because he's a bad guy.
People.
Yeah.
So can you imagine being the owner of that house, hearing those popping sounds that sound like gunshots, and watching the police swarm your yard with no idea why?
Yeah, no, it would be terrifying. And I I get scared just thinking about police. So when they're close to me, my heart would have probably exploded. Pressure. I would have done. Yeah. I would have
done. Yeah. I don't know what I would have done. I mean, Minnie said that she didn't think she'd be able to tear herself away from the window, even though the safer thing to do would be to get on the floor.
Right.
In case
right.
of a stray bullet. But right. I probably would just stand there stunned for yeah. like a minute and then yeah. dive for the floor.
Well, you know, we've actually been in this situation because one day I came home from work and the DEA and the FBI and the Phoenix PD was at my neighbor's house.
Oh, my
God. And old Whitey, and this is why I think it's interesting to hear Minnie say she would have a hard time tearing herself away from the window, because that was what my husband was doing.
Old Whitey,
but my
yeah.
thought was to let's go inside as far away as we can.
Yeah,
from
actually,
these
let's
people,
get in the car and
yeah,
go
with guns
and drive to Canada.
Exactly, who can ruin our lives or take them without any consequences? So. it's just funny. Our lived experiences kind yeah. of bring us to the conclusions that we end up in. And it's just funny because our backgrounds yeah, are very different.
Yeah. So the owner of the house later said that he felt fortunate that Brown had gone to hide under the swing set instead of coming into his house. And yeah.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. So once Brown realized that he was not getting away and that there were no milkshakes in this particular yard, he shot himself in the head. He injured himself pretty badly enough that police were able to apprehend him, but he did not die from the wounds.
Police summoned EMS and Brown was taken to the hospital where he survived coherent, though in critical condition. The next day, Brown was charged with the additional murders. Eugene Jennings' family said they could now find some sense of closure knowing that Brown had been apprehended.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
And hi, true crime fans.
We're the co-hosts of She Goes By Jane. Every week, we'll be covering the story of a missing or unidentified woman in the United States.
Stories you may have heard before.
And ones whose stories didn't make it into the news.
We've been covering these stories for a while, first in Amy's book of poetry, Doe.
And then in Vanessa's documentary, She.
But now we want to share them with you here on She Goes By Jane.
And each week, we'll be joined by a special guest who will read a poem in honor of the women we talk about. Can we say who?
We can say who. We'll be joined by actresses like Coco Jones and Gabrielle Ruiz.
And musicians like Stephanie Quayle and Kelly Moneymaker, along with authors like Louise Penny.
And Catherine McKenzie.
So check out She Goes By Jane wherever you get your podcasts, or check out Evergreen Podcasts and their true crime channel, Killer Podcasts.
We can't wait to bring you these stories.
On February 26, 2020, Lauren Harrington's mother, Tracy Harrington, said during a news interview that she wanted to know why Brown had been free and allowed to be an informant instead of locked away in prison after multiple probation violations.
Good question.
Yeah.
While surrounded by five of her son's eight children, Tracy asked, quote, did they know where he was at all times? Did they know who he was associating with? Did they know what he was doing? If they knew all of these things, if he's working for you, why did my son get killed? You come to my house and you tell me why my son was murdered by a man that was working for you, and I'll let it rest, unquote.
Wow.
Shots fired.
Seriously, that's a bar. I mean,
yeah.
And I watched the press conference with the police chief, and their answer wasn't a good one.
No,
it was we didn't really look into it. It wasn't really our fault. It was their fault. A lot of finger pointing, which is useless.
Yeah.
So at this time, a federal court spokesman told the Detroit News that despite multiple violations while on federal probation for a 2014 gun arrest, Brown was allowed to remain free at the request of an unnamed federal law enforcement agency. But U.S. Attorney Matthew Schneider said that he had found no evidence of that. Of course he said that.
Yeah.
Bullshit. Yeah, exactly.
According to Detroit Police Chief James Craig, Brown was an informant for the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, or ATF. The same day Brown was released from federal supervision on October 29, 2019, a Detroit police officer assigned to the DEA task force signed Brown up to be an informant for them on gangs and drugs.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I'm just looking at the dates, 2019. And by then we'd known the war on drugs wasn't an effective war.
Yeah.
On gangs or drugs. And the Detroit police chief, you know, I wonder too if it had something to do with the way the police had been portrayed in the media at this time, especially in the Midwest. I mean, this wasn't long after Michael Brown was murdered.
Oh, right.
And, you know, wanting a win. Yeah. And if we can get an informant, maybe it'll help us get more wins. I don't know.
Yeah.
So when the ATF that handed off Brown to the Detroit DEA task force on October 29th, they never mentioned his repeated probation violations. Oopsies. Left that out of the memo. And the officer who signed Brown up did not know about his past crimes while under federal supervision. That uh-huh. is such bullshit. Yeah.
Bullshit.
They know yeah. everything about all of us. How did they not know that?
According to Craig, Brown was paid $150 after he told police he had information about drug activity involving a Southwest Detroit gang. His information didn't pan out. And Craig said that was the only time Brown was used by the task force as an informant. And when the department learned he was a suspect in the two homicides in River Rouge, they deactivated him as an informant.
Wow. For some reason, I thought the money was better for informants. They just paid him $150.
That was for one tip, and it didn't pan out.
Yeah.
So it was pointless. It was completely pointless.
Yeah. And I wonder if he, too, saw that the writing was on the wall. Like, oh, man, it didn't work.
Mm-hmm. Could be.
Anyway, so Craig said that when you look at his crimes, they all have a connection to money, drugs, or both. Quote, it was clear he had a significant drug problem. He spiraled out of control and began to use violence, unquote. Craig also said he had a conversation with U.S. Attorney Matthew Schneider, and they both agreed to take a deeper look at what happened in this case. Wow. You know what? And they only did so. I really don't think they would have done so. For 5 minutes, but they wouldn't have taken any look if he had not been connected to law enforcement as an informant.
Yeah,
remember, all the victims were black, so it would have been really easy
if that embarrassing situation hadn't cropped up, then probably would not have taken any look at it. Yeah.
Oh yeah, you get it.
Yep. Schneider released a statement on February 26, 2020, saying, quote, this is a horrible tragedy. We are going to do everything in our power to get to the bottom of this matter. Kenyel Brown was a law enforcement informant for a period of time, and we have been and currently are working closely with our law enforcement partners to determine exactly what happened. It is our obligation to act as transparently as we can in a responsible manner by obtaining the facts. The family of the victims deserve nothing less, unquote. Why do I feel like smoke is being blown up my ass?
It is. I thought you were going to. It is very, very. You're right. Ding, ding, ding. I can't think of anything else to say. Ding, ding, ding. All
ding,
the smoke is up.
Ding.
It's up all of our asses.
Do you feel that?
They say you're not supposed to blow into microphones, but this is so appropriate. But Keith Corbett, a former federal prosecutor who dealt with informants as chief of the Organized Crime and Racketeering Unit for the U.S. Attorney's Office for 20 years, said he is skeptical that police didn't know about Brown's repeated probation violations. Thank you. We all feel the same way, Mr. Corbett.
Yeah. Corbett said, quote, when you're dealing with informants, you're not dealing with choir boys. They had to know that he was involved in a lot of criminal activity in order to have any reason to expect that he would be a decent informant, unquote. Mm-hmm. Adding that his parole violations should not have been difficult to spot.
I know. I just, I'm sure it's in a computer somewhere. Yeah. This is 2019. So Corbett, who is now a criminal defense attorney, all right, Mr. Corbett, said that when he first heard about Brown's alleged killing spree, he felt that someone failed to properly monitor him. Thank you, failure of the system. That informants are supposed to be monitored by agencies that use them, and it appears that it wasn't being done in this case. Thank you. This guy needs to run for president. Where is Corbett?
Corbett explained that when law enforcement wants to use an ex-convict as an informant, they sometimes seek to have them discharged from supervised release so that they can use them in criminal situations to bust others. Because when someone's on probation or supervised release, they are not allowed to have any contact with other known felons or engage in any criminal activity.
But when a judge removes them from federal custody and ends probation terms, the informant is free to work with law enforcement and engage in activities with criminals that would otherwise be forbidden, such as undercover drug buys. Whoa.
Corbett said that's what likely happened in Brown's case. Law enforcement wanted to use him in ways that the terms of his probation didn't allow, so they, quote, got him off the books, unquote. But he added, quote, I don't think anyone had a real expectation that he was going to go off the rails like this, unquote. And that's probably true.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. But you all are still playing with people's lives.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It is not good.
Fucked up.
Uh-huh. So when she learned of the situation, Dorian Patterson's fiance, Precious Moore, said, quote, someone needs to be held accountable for this. They kept this guy out of prison because he was an informant. Six people had to die so police could get a couple drug dealers off the street, unquote. Thank you. Wow. Yeah. Bars. These yeah. people, these are just truth bombs.
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
I can't, like, episode done. Stopping the recording.
Kimberly Green's daughter, Brianna Green, also questioned why Brown wasn't kept in prison. Quote, what happened is a clear injustice, and my mother deserves justice. We believe the system needs to answer for this. Why was this man allowed to be free? Unquote.
Well, we are all wondering the same thing. But now we're going to get into where are they now?
Brown ended up succumbing to his self-inflicted wounds while in the hospital on February 28, 2020. I guess you could say that there were actually seven murders, the last one being himself.
No, you can't. I don't think so.
not the same thing, but still. Another life taken.
Nah, I must say that's enough for me, dog.
Okay.
But now we're going to get into what we think made him snap and our takeaway. So this is from Minnie. Doing drugs. So Minnie goes on to say, I don't think this guy was a sociopath or a narcissist because I don't think that kind of person would kill themselves. Though I defer to the superior knowledge of the OG of true crime, if I'm wrong about that. And I think he was just a lifelong drug addict, starting drugs at a pretty young age. Like you'll always say, though this is an explanation, it is not an excuse. His drug addiction doesn't excuse him from what he did, but he clearly needed treatment and didn't get it. In my opinion, this whole thing might have been prevented with some early intervention, rehab, therapy, not prison. And that's for many. Couldn't agree more. Yeah. Hip hop air horns for Minnie. Actually, how about this?
Another one.
Thank you, Minnie.
I totally agree with Minnie.
Yeah.
And it's disgusting that instead of getting this guy some help for his drug addiction, they exploited his addiction and tried to use him as an informant.
Yeah.
Clearly, they didn't see him as a human being. And to what end, as Precious Moore said, six people had to die so the police could get a couple of drug dealers off the street, which they didn't even do.
Right. Yeah.
I think it's probably typical of our quote unquote justice system, unfortunately.
Our criminal legal system, as some call it now, because it's not really a justice system.
No, it's not. You're right. Criminal legal system. I agree with Minnie. This whole thing could have been avoided had he gotten some help early on, like way early on when he first started doing drugs as a child. I think he just got to a point where he just didn't give a fuck about anything anymore.
Yeah, so. I agree with you and Minnie. I think his work as an informant and the drugs did it, and they used him. They used him up. And my understanding about informants is they are paid, but that money comes from taxpayers. And there was a failure by the police who retained him to look into his criminal history, which, you know, six people are dead. And for what? And being an informant, I listened to a podcast talking about Kenyell Brown, and it was by men who had been in the system in federal prison, and they talked about how it can be really stressful to be an informant.
Wow.
And the fear of getting found out, but the pressure of also having to give law enforcement the tips.
What they want.
And so being under all that pressure, I think also might have contributed to his drug use getting out of control.
Yeah.
And contributed to his state of mind being so poor and making these horrible decisions.
Agreed.
All right. Well, now it's time to talk about how not to get murdered. So, if you love true crime and you don't want to die, here's a tip for you.
This segment is not intended to be victim blaming. We thought of this segment because I read somewhere that a lot of people listen to true crime because they want to know what they can do to be safer. This is not meant to blame the victims. It's just learning from other people's experiences.
Oh, no. The tip bag is empty.
It's empty. It's empty again. You guys need to send us in some tips.
Send us in some tips, y'all. You can send them to at Fruit Loops Pod anywhere on social media, or fruitloopspod@gmail.com, or 602-935-6294. Okay, that's bad. Now it's shout out time, where we shout out any content by or about any people of color, LGBTQ folks, or any marginalized people, and or any true crime goodies. So I have two things.
Okay.
So there's a lot going on in Iran. And I heard an interview today with Moj Madara, and you can follow her on Instagram at Moj, M-O-J. And she's an Iranian woman, an activist, and she has a link on her link tree. And there's this living document called How to Talk About Iran. And it has updates on people arrested, updates on activists, updates on who to follow, updates on how to support, updates on what's really going on. Wow. And I just found it really, really useful and helpful. You know, we all want to be good global citizens. Yeah. So if you don't know where to start, I would say start with her. And I also wanted to shout out, because we are recording this the week of Indigenous Peoples Day, a podcast I listen to is American Prestige. And they had an episode today titled This Land is Their Land with David Silverman, who is a professor of Native American, Colonial American, and American racial history at George Washington University. And this guy knows his stuff. I think he's white, but man, oh man, he could get it, because he is so... He laid it all out. This country, you cannot talk about our successes without our horrors, including genocide of Indigenous people, and how traumatic this time of year can be for our Indigenous fam. So check that episode out. What do you got?
Awesome. Well, I'm late to the party, but this week I listened to Lolita podcast. Have you listened
Jamie
to
Loftus?
It?
I haven't, but I'm a big fan of Jamie Loftus.
Yeah. So Jamie Loftus analyzes the book Lolita by Vladimir Nabokov. It's misinterpretations and how it's been treated in popular culture. So have you read Lolita before?
No. I thought the only Lolita I know is the Lolita Express, which is Jeffrey Epstein's predatory plane.
Gross. Did you? That's so gross.
Yeah, I did
read Lolita, and I really like it. People always think, so one of the misinterpretations, people think it's about a sexy girl who seduces an older man. It's not. That's not the story at all.
It's
the story.
Not?
No. The story is about a pedophile, basically. And it's from his point of view, and he's a unreliable narrator. So he's telling the story. And Lolita is 12.
What?
Her name isn't even Lolita. It's Dolores. But he calls her Lolita. Yeah.
Ew. Oh, so, my God. I had no idea. Oh,
I know.
God.
Yeah. Oh, so she goes into like deep dives about how women are treated and how Black women are treated, like the sexualization and stuff like that. And
it's really
good.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah, no, she's an amazing writer, an amazing comedian. And I just appreciate her every time she pops up on one of my favorite podcasts.
Behind the Bastards. She's on that a lot. And when I started listening to it, I didn't even know that it was her. That popped up in my feed. So I started listening and I was like, I know this voice. And
yes. When
she said her name was Jamie Loftus, I was like, that's the lady on Behind the Bastards.
Yes. And so she did a podcast. She has all these limited series. One of them, My Year in Mensa. And when she got into Mensa because she's super smart. And she was in Phoenix. And I saw her downtown.
Oh, my God. Are you serious?
The Mensa,
get together.
I don't know, convention or celebration. I don't know what those people
Mensa,
do.
Clap each other on the back and say congratulations.
So I wanted to like shout her name. We were doing Fruit Loops at the time, like, Jamie, I love you. But I didn't. Instead, I messaged her on Instagram. She didn't reply. But anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right on. Yeah. So anyway, that's it. That's all I got this week.
Okay. That is a really great recommendation. I had no idea. I'm horrified and I'm going to listen to this Lolita podcast. I
binged it. Like, I think there's like 10 episodes.
Okay.
And it's a limited series. So there's like 10 episodes and I binged it. I totally binged it. It's really good.
Oh man, I can't wait. So that is, follow Moj Madara at MOJ on Instagram for more information about what's going on in Iran and what you can do to help. American Prestige, episode 72 specifically, this land is their land, not ours. if wherever you get your podcasts, and also the Lolita podcast by Jamie Loftus, and Lolita podcast can be found wherever you get your podcasts. And she has a ton of other works that you should check out as well. So that's... I'm like, what's next?
The end is next.
All right, Beth, tell the people where to find us.
Our website is fruitloopspod.com and we use Fruit Loops Pod for all of our social media. Join our discussion group on Facebook at Fruit Loops Pod Discussion. If you want to support the show, you can send us a donation on the Cash App. Just Google Fruit Loops Pod Cash App, or you can become a monthly patron through Patreon. As always, we have merch for sale on our website.
That's right. Now, this is a weekly podcast and new episodes drop every Thursday. So until next time, look alive, y'all. It's crazy out there.
Detective came and knocked on the door, and I said, "Is it Renee?" And he just gave me that solemn look.
It was the worst day ever.
The Proof Podcast is back with a new case and a new season. 23 years ago, 18-year-old Renee Ramos went missing. Her body was later found in an empty Home Depot building on the edge of town.
I don't think that they arrested the right people. It's about time somebody's trying to do something.
She had a black eye about 2 weeks before she was murdered.
They are involved. They definitely had her body and her backpack.
You know people are going to judge you, right?
Of course. They're judging me now. They've been judging me damn near my whole life.
You can listen now to season 2 of Proof wherever you get your podcasts and follow along with us as we reinvestigate the murder at the warehouse.
I have to ask, did you kill Renee?
From DNA testing to the Dixie Mafia, Crime Capsule brings you new stories of true crime in American history. I'm your host, Benjamin Morris. Join us for exclusive interviews with authors from Arcadia Publishing, writing the hottest books on the most chilling stories of our country's past. You can find us wherever you get your favorite podcasts or on evergreenpodcasts.com. Crime Capsule, history so interesting, it's criminal.